Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded August 2nd, 2023. Well, this week, Victoria's Women in Black will convene to again commemorate the hundreds of thousands perished in the twin atrocities visited on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The women, too, will bear silent vigil for the millions more killed, maimed, and rendered homeless in the 78 years of wars waged since the atomic bombing of Japan. Terry Wolfwood is director and co-founder of the Bernard Boker Center Foundation. She's a writer, poet, photographer, and longtime activist in pursuit of peace, social justice, and women's rights. Her articles have appeared at Briar Patch, Peace News, Third World Resurgence, and at the foundation site bbcf.ca. Terry has served, too, as local coordinator for the Women in Black for many years and traveled numerous times to the refugee camps cum towns and cities in Palestine and Western Sahara. Terry Wolfwood in the first half. And yes, war is hell, but those fighting it are not born demons. Some are just made that way, systematically robotized, inured to human compassion, decency, and mercy, psychologically inoculated to become ruthless killers on command. And that moral immunity persists after and between wars. Evan Reif is a freelance writer whose articles appear at Covert Action magazine. The son of a miner and librarian from Western South Dakota, Evan says his father's union organizing and their community's deindustrialization trauma fostered a, quote, deep interest in left-wing politics and made him a staunch anti-fascist. Evan's latest piece at CAM, Lord of the Underworld, Meet the Paratrooper from North Carolina, who helped orchestrate the war in Ukraine, follows a string of articles on the role of America and Americans in the tragedy over there. Evan Reif on Ukraine's descent to hell and the conductors keeping the demonic tune playing in the second half. But first, Terry Wolfwood, remembering the shadows of war past and present. Welcome back to the program, Terry.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Glad to be here.
Well, it's always my pleasure to speak with you, of course. Now, Terry, we've spoken around this time every year for some time now, and every time it seems to me the collective memory of what was done in Japan becomes foggier and foggier. Firstly, though, Terry, where and when will you and the Women in Black be standing vigil this year?
Okay, our vigil this year will be in the same place it's been for a number of years, which is on Government Street across from the Empress Hotel, below the tourist office. There's a big space there, and we'll be there with our big banner and also our banner for especially for Hiroshima Day.
Well, Terry, for those that haven't been listening to us talk about this over the years, can you reiterate for those new to it, who the Women in Black are and what the parameters are? I'm thinking specifically that, you know, you don't have to be either a woman or dressed in black to participate.
No, we welcome everybody who supports our aim of a world without war and violence, a war in which conflict is solved by peaceful negotiation, and a world that even on a personal level, violence is eradicated by communication and relationship and respect for all people and respect for the planet, because right now our planet is very much in danger. We are all over the world. There are Women in Black everywhere. It started in Jerusalem with Arab and Israeli women coming together to try and end the violence in that country. And we continue all over the world, in Kashmir, in Serbia, in parts of Canada, United States. We are here, and we are here to bear witness to the possibility that we could have a world without war and a world without violence.
Yeah, that seems a pretty remote possibility now. Checking the local newscasts, I've been at this for a long time, not as long as you, but quite a long time, and things seem actually more dire now than I can remember, even going back to the Reagan days when, as a teenager, I thought that any day could be my last with the nuclear threat looming over us like a great Damoclean blade.
Well, it's true. It's a pretty dark time, and we've been through some dark times with almost the button being pressed somewhere in the world and the world being annihilated. And we're also in that danger now, because what we really have is the two world's major nuclear powers facing each other in Ukraine. The United States is there with their nuclear force behind them, and Russia has the other nuclear force. Between them, they have about 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world. So it is a dangerous time, but we got through the others, and we ended up with negotiation, with some accords. We've got the United Nations, which has ratified a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons. So I think there is some hope in the world yet.
Well, when I said in the introduction that, or in the lead-in here, that it seems that over the years, the collective memory of what happened in Japan in 1945 seems to fade. And with it, too, it seems to me that the threat of nuclear war seems more remote to people today than it did, say, in the 1980s, when the fear was tangible and present. And now it seems to me it's taken less seriously, especially in the United States, to listen to their politicians, who seem to be saying, whether they believe it or not, that a limited or smaller scale nuclear war is something that it's a viable tactic and something that is survivable.
It's pretty scary. It's true. And it's also true that there aren't many. You have to be essentially over 80 to have remembered the Hiroshima bomb. And I saw a new movie about, and I own a copy of the new movie, Vow from Hiroshima, which in part is the story of the life of Setsuko Thurlow, who accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for her years of campaigning against nuclear weapons through the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. And she talks about the effects of Hiroshima, and it was a 10 kiloton bomb. That's a very small bomb. The bombs that we have now in our arsenals are much larger, and it would only take about 100 to destroy the world. And as she points out, we could reverse a lot of what we're doing in climate change, but you can't reverse nuclear war once it's happened. So I think it's very important. And those of us who still continue to hope that we could abolish nuclear weapons, and more than 60 nations have signed that treaty. So it's a big treaty, and it's been ratified. So many people think it's possible. The leaders of Austria, Costa Rica, many countries, but not Canada.
Canada has refused again. It seems that this country is on a course that seems rather alien to people of my generation and yours, where it seems we're following the martial drumbeat of our southern neighbors more closely now than any time, perhaps since the Second War.
Well, I was really upset when Trudeau said, our prime minister said recently, that our allies were concerned that we weren't doing enough in the military field. And I felt, and I phoned him up and said, well, Mr. Trudeau, our allies didn't elect you. The citizens of Canada elected you, and the citizens of Canada want health care. They want housing. They want internal security, food security, not warfare on behalf of our NATO friends. So there's a lot to be done and a lot to be said.
What do you mean you phoned him up? Is there? I didn't realize that he was accessible, or is this like a prime minister?
There's a phone number that you can reach for Trudeau at very easily.
Oh, and what do you get? Like an answering machine?
You get a voicemail. You can phone anytime during the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You get voicemail. And if I'd known you were going to ask me, I would have had the number right here, but I'll look it up in a minute.
People can look it up.
While we're talking, I'll look it up.
Well, did you get a response?
No, you don't get a response, but you just add it to it. And of course, you probably get more of a response if you write a letter, but sometimes it's good to just make a phone call.
Well, maybe it's just as well that he didn't answer, because I just saw a video clip of a young guy at a public event who had the temerity to question the Canadian policy on Ukraine, and the prime minister tore into him and accused him of being a proponent of Russian propaganda.
Well, this war between Ukraine and Russia will end up with negotiations just like every war. And for those of us who want to end the war, we call for the negotiations now. More people, a lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides. And we have to think about that, not what our government policy is, but think about our fellow humans.
Well, you know, Terry, this young, still maybe getting a little longer in the tooth now, but this young century has seen nothing but war. And Canada was involved for 15 plus years officially in the war in Afghanistan. Perhaps this Ukraine war is just the next so-called forever war or generational war. And Canada already having doubled its military budget in the past few years can just keep on going until, I don't know, keep squeezing the taxpayer until they cry uncle.
Well, let's hope the taxpayers of Canada will pressure the government to stop this. The taxpayers of Canada are getting pretty desperate with inflation, with housing shortages, with food security. And I think we just have to speak up. We have to tell our government that's not what we want it to do. And other wars have happened. Colombia has had a war, and they've settled their war, and they're working towards peace. Angola has settled the war, so has Mozambique. It is possible to reach an end of a war and to negotiate on behalf of the civilians of every war. And I think we can do that. Canada could be a leader in that if we chose to be.
Well, clearly there's no voice in the Canadian Parliament on any side that's willing to put itself forward as being against Canada's involvement in Ukraine right now. Those members may believe it, you know, personally, but they're not saying anything about it in the House if they do.
Well, the best thing that could happen is that they speak up and say, let's sit down and work on a peace agreement so that the people of both Ukraine and Russia will no longer suffer.
Yeah, well, when you say the people should get out and demand it, I recall being out in the streets in 2001 demanding that Canada not become a part of the coalition of the willing and begin an invasion of Afghanistan. We didn't know then that it would turn into what it did, of course, but many suspected it might turn into a protracted forever war, as George W. Bush had promised. And yet we don't see that kind of engagement amongst the polity, the hoi polloi here in Canada or in any of these countries in the West right now. It seems that the peace movement is confined to some old timers like me and you and some people online, but there's hardly anything going on that I can see, unless I'm missing. I hadn't got the memo or something.
I think the really important thing is to make connections. We cannot solve the climate crisis. We cannot solve our health and housing crisis unless we back away from spending our money on war. And that really message has to get across to our fellow activists in the environmental movement and in the social movement. And that's one of our jobs to do, is to reach out to other activists and just point out the connections. Because if you don't see connections, capitalism and imperialism will always triumph. It's disconnection which causes a lot of the problems.
Yeah. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Terry Wolfwood. Terry's director and co-founder of the Bernard Boker Center Foundation. She's a writer and poet, photographer, and longtime activist in pursuit of peace, social justice, and women's rights. Her articles have appeared at Briar Patch, Peace News, Third World Resurgence, and at the foundation's own site, bbcf.ca.
Well, we welcome people to come to Women in Black
right,
on
let's
Saturday,
read.
August the 5th, at noon, from noon to 1 p.m. Come for all or part of it and join us in respectful silence, remembering that it was Canadian uranium that was in the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We provided the uranium and we're still providing uranium. And so we're very much complicit in, we are actually a nuclear nation, even though we haven't made nuclear weapons. We help with the production of them. We've had them on our soil. They pass through our air and water all the time. So we are a nuclear nation, and let's get out there and say, no, we don't want to be. And you're welcome to join us on Saturday At noon on Government Street across from the Empress Hotel below the tourist office.
Yeah, that's below the big Art Deco spotlight right on the corner up there. Mm-hmm. Well, Canada's role in providing uranium that for the peaceful atom, so-called, and also for the, well, which then is just the first step in weaponizing the byproducts of the atom. We saw just this last week, Niger, or as it's sometimes called, Niger, hived itself from French control. France is one of the most, if not the most, nuclear dependent countries in the world. I think it's 80 some odd percent of their electricity is derived from nuclear energy. And Niger is their key source of uranium. Yeah. And now with the coup government saying that they're not going to deal with France, at least for now, there's a call in France to invade the country. The Americans and presumably their satrap Canada is going to be supportive of that, but going against its own financial interests, because this could be a big boon to Canada's uranium industry once again.
Canada does have a big uranium industry. We're one of the top three countries in the world that export uranium. And much of it was discovered and staked by a French mining company in northern Saskatchewan about 40, 50 years ago. So we are very much involved. We've been involved, as I say, ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when we provided uranium from the Northwest Territories near a village called Denali. And I just wanted to say, because we're on First Nations territory here in Victoria, unceded Songhees, Esquimalt peoples, but it was the peoples of Denali, the men of Denali, who were hired to carry out the uranium ore on their backs and sacks to the barges so it could go down to the United States to be made into the weapons. And so the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb, was killing people even before the bomb was dropped, because most of those men died of cancer. And the village of Denali is called the village of widows, because so many men died mining uranium and not knowing what they were doing. And the government of Canada has never acknowledged that.
Well, yeah, and Terry, you mentioned that the climate emergency going on in the world. Well, proponents have said, well, nuclear energy is the way to go. This is, we have to move and expand nuclear power. And part of the argument from people like George Monbiot of The Guardian is to de-emphasize the dangers that radiation pose to people, even going so far as to saying, oh, well, Chernobyl wasn't such a big deal. It was overblown and hardly anybody died from it, and fewer people are injured by radiation than by coal fumes or from coal burning plants and so forth. What do you think of the idea that nuclear is our way forward here?
Well, there's an atomic energy watchdog of the United Nations, and it has the right to supersede and to conceal any information that the World Health Organization or any public inquiry that has gone into the effects of Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, other nuclear leaks all over the world. So we really don't know what the results of all those accidents were. And what we don't know is the security of these things, because right now there's a nuclear power plant in the middle of the war in Ukraine. We have no idea what's going to happen. So nuclear plants are very insecure militarily. What we really need to do is to de-emphasize that and to create power sources like solar and wind and sophisticate them so that people can control themselves in their own communities. And there's no threat to anybody when they have this power in their own communities.
Yeah, decentralization. But that seems to be something that the top-down society will move heaven and earth to avoid happening, that people being free of the central power authorities of all sorts.
Exactly. So we've got a lot to do, and it is connected very much to the climate crisis, to what we do with energy. And there's a finite amount of everything on this world. And what we have to do is make do with less and be more careful of our environment, and to try and use less energy and fewer resources. Resources are finite, and we can't use them all up in our lifetime in the next 100 years. So we have to be very careful. And we can't continue to live so extravagantly as we are now. Some of us, anyhow. It's only a very small percentage of the world that's able to do that. And the gap between the rich and the poor is growing at the same time.
Well, that gap is growing both between nations and within nations as well, as we've seen in Canada. And as you mentioned, with the Canada's increased war spending and the decrease in spending in areas like healthcare and other avenues of social uplift in this country, it's quite shocking that a quarter of Canadians don't have family doctors, and the state of the medical system, to anybody who's experienced it over these last few years especially, is a disgrace, really.
Yeah, it is indeed. I mean, we're one of the richest countries in the world, and just drive down Pandora Street and have a look at what the richest, one of the richest cities in the richest country in the world, one of the richest countries in the world, treat our marginalized citizens. It's shocking and it's disgusting.
Well, for those not from Victoria, Pandora Street is a main thoroughfare heading into the city that has a broad and lovely boulevard that now has become a tent city, running for about a kilometer or so of people, you know, homeless people and people on the fringes, marginalized, as Terry says. Well, Terry, the idea of these forever wars isn't new in every part of the world. Israel-Palestine or Palestine with Israel plopped on top of it is an example. You've been to the refugee camps of Palestine on more than one occasion. It seems now, while all eyes are turning towards Ukraine, the distraction of that war has emboldened the Israeli military into further atrocity in the West Bank, not just Gaza, but concentrating on the West Bank areas, burning olive groves, tearing down people's houses. And I'm just seeing an article in Haaretz where a former Mossad chief, Tamir Pardo, he compares the Israeli right of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government as being akin to the KKK.
Well, it certainly is a form of genocide and a form of ethnocide against Palestinians. They're either being driven out of their homes within the West Bank, or they're being driven out of the West Bank altogether. Massive, you know, immigration, because people can't live there anymore. I've seen the destruction of homes. I've been there and I've watched it. I've watched olive trees being cut down. I've watched houses being bulldozed. I've camped with people who are waiting for to see if their villages are going to be destroyed, and they ask for internationalists to come. But there are many people who still support Israel. This, and there are many people there right now today who are standing there with the with Israel, but there are more and more people standing there with the Palestinians and people coming from the countries that are supporting Israel, but many of their citizens support Palestine. It's quite wonderful when you go there. You see an awful lot of internationalists, and they're very dedicated, as the Palestinians are. They have something called samud, and samud is the Arab word for being steadfast, steadfastness. And if anybody is steadfast, it's the Palestinians about their land and their home.
Well, and equally in Western Sahara, another place that you visited, off air, we talked a little bit about the recent recognition by the United States of Moroccan claims to Western Sahara, based, the cynics would say, on Morocco's long delayed recognition of Israel's legitimacy as a state. What's the latest you hear from your friends in Western Sahara, or those that know a lot more about it?
Well, it's to be expected, because Israel and the United States are the closest of allies. And indeed, the Moroccans are buying an awful lot of surveillance equipment for the berm, which is the wall that separates Morocco and Algeria, where many of the refugees from Western Sahara are. And they can't get back into the country because there are about 10 million landmines there. So it's not a surprise, but then just remember, the rest of Africa recognizes that Western Sahara is the last colony in Africa, and it's a colony of Morocco, and people are standing behind the Western Sahara. Other countries across the world are too, and their time will come also. They are also in Samud, both the Western Sahara people who are oppressed within Western Sahara and those who live in the camps in Algeria and across the world. There are organizing all the time.
Well, it seems, and the news is full of it now, and I expect in the weeks to come it's only going to be more so, that Central Africa and in a band of countries coalescing from the Atlantic to the Red Sea are standing in unison against colonialism led by the Niger coup in Burkina Faso. They seem to have had enough. And I was amazed to see something I didn't know was that many of these countries, former French colonies, still pay billions of dollars annually to France, their former colonial overlords, for what, so that they won't come back or what?
Most of them have signed agreements to allow the military of France to intervene as well. That's in their independence statement in Mali and other countries. And of course, the other thing to remember is that countries of West Africa are extremely mineral rich. And they're all very important and valuable to Western powers. And so there's a lot of activity there.
Well, the weeks to come are going to be certainly enlightening, I think, for a lot of people as it comes to neocolonialism.
Nobody had ever heard of Niger until last week, had they? How many people in Canada knew anything about Niger until last week?
Well, you remember the yellow cake during the Iraq War, and Niger became a big part of the Iraq, the lead up to the invasion, the second Iraq War, and the so-called WMDs. It all comes, it seems, around in full circle. Mm-hmm. Terry, we're fast out of time. I feel like I've been the negative Nelly, and you're struggling to, you know, leave our listeners with a positive message in the last minute we have. Can you do that? Can you provide your uplift?
The American author Alice Walker, Afro-American author, once said, "Social activism is the rent we pay for the privilege of living on this earth. And if you don't act as a social activism, you're not paying your rent. So let's get out there and do what we can. Everybody can do something in their own way. We want peace and we want universality of rights and benefits."
Yeah, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. Right. So again, it's Saturday coming, the
August the 5th.
In front of the Empress.
Yeah, on Government Street, underneath the tourist office, from noon to 1 p.m. on Saturday, August the 5th at noon. Love to have people who support us and support our aims come and stand behind us with the banner. We have a big banner that says Women in Black, and all those who support them and our aims are very welcome to come.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry, for coming on. And remember, the Bernard Boker Center Foundation is at bbcf.ca. And perhaps see you down there Saturday, August 5th, midday.
All right.
Thanks, Terry. All right, then. Bye-bye. And I want everyone else to stick around, because I'm going to be speaking with Evan Reif after the break. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, yes, war is hell, but those fighting it are not born demons. Some are just made that way, systemically robotized, inured to human compassion, decency, and mercy, psychologically inoculated to become ruthless killers on command. And that moral immunity persists after and between the wars. Evan Reif is a freelance writer whose articles appear at Covert Action magazine. The son of a miner and librarian from Western South Dakota, Evan says his father's union organizing and their community's deindustrialization trauma fostered a deep interest in left-wing politics and made him a, quote, staunch anti-fascist. Evan's latest piece at CAM, Lord of the Underworld, Meet the Paratrooper from North Carolina who helped orchestrate the war in Ukraine, follows a string of his articles on the role of America and Americans in the tragedy going on over there. Welcome to the program, Evan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Evan, your article contains a cast of what I found to be sick-making characters, beginning with Brian Boyinger, who you describe as a, quote, normal young man from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.